Ja, willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von Beyond Billions, dem Private Markets Podcast der Börsenzeitung. Mein Name ist Philipp Habdank. Ich bin Reporter bei der Börsenzeitung und wie ihr alle wisst, spreche ich hier normalerweise einmal pro Woche mit jemand Spannendes aus der Private Markets Szene. Heute machen wir das mal ein kleines bisschen anders, denn wir starten eine neue Rubrik bei Beyond Billions. The American View on Private Markets haben wir das genannt. Was hat es damit auf sich? Ich habe mir schon länger gedacht, Mensch, wir haben mit dem Alex Wehner doch so einen Mega-Kollegen in New York sitzen. Da muss ich mal ein bisschen Kapital draus schlagen. Und warum drücken wir dem nicht einfach ein Mikro in die Hand und lassen ihn mal auf die US-amerikanische Private Market Szene los? Denn wäre es nicht spannend, mal US-Experten zu Themen zu interviewen, wie die denn auf den Markt schauen, also sowohl auf ihren Heimatmarkt in den USA, aber halt auch, wie gucken denn die Amerikaner auf die europäischen Private Markets? So, und gesagt, getan, das haben wir gemacht. Alex ist losgerannt, hat ein Interview geführt und ist mir jetzt einmal zugeschaltet. Hi Alex.
Hi Philipp, freut mich dabei zu sein.
Wie ist es in New York?
Ja, gut soweit. Also wir haben etwas aushaltbarere Temperaturen, glaube ich, als zuletzt in Europa. Und ja, die Fußball-WM läuft auch ohne Deutschland. Ja, also wir genießen hier den Sommer.
Nice. Sehr, sehr geil, dass du an Bord bist für unsere neue Rubrik The American View on Private Markets. Sag doch mal so ein bisschen was zu dir, was du da in den USA so drüben treibst, außer Fußball zu gucken.
Genau, also ich bin ja seit Anfang 2023 hier in New York für die Börsenzeitung und ja, habe hier ein sehr, sehr breites Themenfeld, was ich covere. Also natürlich die Wall Street, die US-Banken, aber eben auch Tech, Öl, Autos, alles, was die US-Wirtschaft so prägt und hergibt. Und natürlich sind Private Markets hier ein Riesenthema und etwas, was massiv im Fokus steht, nicht nur bei den Alternatives-Riesen selbst, sondern eben auch bei den Banken, die, wie du ja auch immer wieder berichtest, teilweise schon sehr lange dabei sind, aber ihre Bemühungen eben im Bereich Private Markets stark angekurbelt haben. Und natürlich aber auch für die Unternehmen, die die Finanzierung in Anspruch nehmen. Und ja, da hatten wir ja jetzt einige spannende Monate, die wir da hinter uns gebracht haben, mit zahlreichen Marktturbulenzen, um die sich hier das Gespräch auch stark dreht.
Genau, das ganze Thema Private Credit Krise, was wir auch schon viel hoch und runter geschrieben haben in der Börsenzeitung, auch hier im Podcast, haben wir ja schon viel drüber gesprochen, aber halt immer so mit einer ordentlichen Distanz, sowohl räumlich als auch inhaltlich, weil wir ja hier in Europa ein bisschen anders vielleicht auch auf den Markt gucken als das, was in den USA passiert. Von daher sehr, sehr cool, dass wir da dann ab sofort auch mal O-Töne aus Amerika von dir bekommen. Aber sag doch mal zum Start, mit wem hast du denn jetzt das erste Interview geführt und über was genau habt ihr gesprochen?
Mein Gesprächspartner war oder ist Anthony Abernathy, ein Finanzmanager mit sehr, sehr viel Erfahrung, der einst, ja, als, hier würde man Technologist sagen, ja, also als jemand, der Technologie entwickelt hat, der für technologische Anwendungen zuständig war, gestartet ist und dann ja im Prinzip für ein Who's Who der Finanzszene gearbeitet hat, später eben auch im Vertrieb, weil Finanzdienstleister, Vermögensverwalter und so natürlich einen großen Bedarf daran haben, Leute im Vertrieb einzusetzen, die verstehen, wovon sie da reden. Anthony hat unter anderem für Morgan Stanley gearbeitet, aber auch zum Beispiel für die Credit Suisse und ist jetzt CEO bei Archway. Archway ist ein Wealth Management Dienstleister, zu deren Portfolio oder zu deren Kundenbasis ja eine ganze Reihe an sehr großen Family Offices zählen und die im Prinzip für diese Family Offices ja alle möglichen Dienstleistungen übernehmen im Reporting, im Accounting, was Steuern betrifft etc. All das, worum sich die Manager dieser Family Offices eben ungern selber kümmern oder was sie gerne outsourcen, weil es einfach enorme Ressourcen bindet und man sich da eben auf die Verwaltung seiner Mittel konzentrieren will. Und Anthony hat das übernommen im vergangenen Jahr, die Leitung von Archway. Zuvor hat Aquiline, das ist die Private Equity Mutter hinter Archway, auch beraten beim Kauf sozusagen der Assets, aus denen Archway dann hervorgegangen ist. Und war dann selber wohl der geeignetste Kandidat mit seiner Erfahrung, um da den CEO-Posten zu übernehmen.
Und was sind so seine vielleicht so ein, zwei Hot Takes, über die ihr gesprochen habt? So Thema war dann ja Family Offices und was die so in den Private Markets treiben in den USA. Was sind da so die zwei, drei spannenden oder Hauptthemen, auf die wir uns gleich beim Interview gefasst machen können?
Ja, also er glaubt, dass die Bedeutung von Family Offices in den Private Markets schon auch bedeutend zunimmt, also als Kapitalgeber, als Co-Investoren, da eben das Vermögen, was diese Family Offices verwalten, massiv wächst. Es läuft ja in den USA auch ein unglaublich großer, hier sagt man Intergenerational Wealth Transfer, also ein generationenübergreifender Vermögenstransfer, wo Billionen Dollar an jüngere Generationen vererbt werden, die damit natürlich irgendwas anzufangen suchen. Und an den Private Markets wissen wir ja auch, dass dort mitunter attraktivere Renditen und Strukturen locken als an den Public Markets. Deswegen beobachtet Anthony, dass das Interesse bei seinen Kunden da nach wie vor sehr groß ist. Er hat natürlich auch über die jüngsten Marktturbulenzen gesprochen und wie das den Markt prägt. Und glaubt eben auch, dass Family Offices künftig damit mit zunehmendem Gewicht mit einer anderen Verhandlungsmacht rangehen, was auch die Kapitalbindungsfristen von bestimmten Private Equity, Private Credit Fonds einfach verändern wird, wo die Anbieter eben ja weitaus weniger diese sehr langfristigen Strukturen einfach so durchdrücken können, weil bei den Family Offices einfach ein anderer Bedarf besteht, auch das Kapital abrufen zu können, ja, Ausschüttungen zu generieren. Und für die Family Offices selbst beinhaltet das natürlich auch gewisse Herausforderungen. Je komplexer, je intransparenter ihre Assets werden, desto schwieriger werden auch die Prozesse rundherum. Rechnungslegung, ja, Accounting, Reporting, die Steuerthematik, und das ist natürlich auch was, wovon sich Archway selbst dann gewisse Vorteile oder eine höhere Nachfrage nach ihren Dienstleistungen verspricht.
Klar, cool, klingt super spannend. Ich würde sagen, da verlieren wir jetzt keine weitere Zeit und springen direkt in dein Interview rein. Das ist natürlich auf Englisch, ist ja auch The American View on Private Markets. Und ich würde sagen, viel Spaß mit dem Interview. Let's go.
Ich hoffe, unseren Lesern gefällt's oder unseren Zuhörern gefällt's. Und ich bin ans Schriftformat gewöhnt, wie man hören kann, aber immer gerne im Podcast dabei. Und hoffe, da sind einige spannende Takes dabei, bei denen auch europäische Hörer was mitnehmen können über den US-Markt. Und natürlich äußert sich Anthony auch zu seiner Perspektive auf Europa. Also da ist vielleicht ein bisschen was dabei für unsere Hörer.
Mit Sicherheit. Und dann würde ich sagen, los geht's. Interview ab.
Welcome, dear listeners, to our podcast Beyond Billions for Börsenzeitung. I'm Alex Wehnert, correspondent in New York for Börsenzeitung. And I'm very excited to welcome Anthony Abernathy to the show. Anthony started out as a technologist, later transitioned into sales and worked for a who is who, you could say, in the financial industry. Morgan Stanley, Investment Technology Group, Nomura, and our dearly remembered Credit Suisse. And today, Anthony is CEO of Archway, a portfolio company of Aquiline that offers solutions for reporting and accounting and a wide array of other services to family offices, mostly in the wealth management space. Anthony, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, as am I.
Our podcast is called Beyond Billions, but what we're talking about is trillions, right? There's a large intergenerational wealth transfer underway. You look at numbers from firms like Cerulli Associates, they say that in the US alone, by 2045, boomers and four following generations will sort of leave or transition 84 trillion, I think recent estimates even 124 trillion to their children or other relatives. How do you think on a large scale all this money that is sort of bestowed upon a younger generation will shape investment behavior in the U.S.?
I think it's a really good question. I think that, you know, you're talking about, and you made the point, like it's an enormous amount of wealth that's being passed down in this generational wealth transfer process. And I think that, you know, it's interesting as we are about a year into our Archway journey since Aquiline purchased it, you know, I think us getting a very broad kind of exposure to both the hard and soft sciences of running a family office, because there's a lot of psychology to it too, right? And ultimately, you know, when you take that kind of wealth on and don't have proper financial trading, as an example, like, and being prudent about how you kind of think about portfolio management and asset protection, I think the complexity will become more and more acute in the space, because I think what's going to happen is, as you go down that generational wealth stack, it's a pyramid, right? It's not, you go from the same number of family members, you're going out and going out through, you know, whatever the number is. I mean, we have clients that are on G8. So you can only imagine how many family members and how many consumers of the products, the reports that we're doing, we have. And I think that what will happen is it means that there'll be, well, I'm going to go diversify into something else. I think what you saw even in this last step of kind of complexity growth, a lot in the sponsor space, right? We have a lot of clients who have a lot of alternative investments. And that has made the management of this wealth more complicated, because there is no normalization of how people are doing document formation, distribution, ingestion. So there's a lot of things that get done to kind of make the process more front to back. But I think what you'll see across the states is, I think you're just going to see more diversity of holdings. And it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting, actually, if we go too far into this path, but like in the environmental kind of space, responsible investing, that kind of has gone through a peak and now it's ebbed. And I wonder, as you have those folks inheriting that wealth, will you start seeing that come back?
Mm-hmm. So which other major trends, as you mentioned, sort of how the market is evolving, do you see on the investment side?
Well, I think, you know, what you've seen over these last few years have been a lot of investment in the private side, right? And I think both through the sponsor world, through private equity and venture, but I also think through, you know, a lot of companies have stayed public for a long time. I mean, private for a long time, you know, and obviously SpaceX is, maybe it's a seminal event that just happened, even though today I read that, you know, now OpenAI is considering kind of delaying its IPO because of the SpaceX, you know, softness and its price. But no one should have been that surprised by it, right? And especially there'll be more lockups as this go, and those lockups come in the market, and it's a tight, they put a tight float out there. And so, but without going too far into that, I think that there's these cycles in these markets, and I think there's been a big move towards private investments. And we see it in our business because we provide, you know, general ledger reporting, lifestyle management, and software. And then we also provide services around doing things like portfolio reconciliation and bill pay. And we are seeing more and more from family offices that they are very keen to want to outsource a lot of this work to people like us.
Mm-hmm. So there's a technological challenge here, right? Which kinds of family offices are looking to outsource their functions? Is there sort of a bifurcation in the market, maybe between?
Yeah, I there's clearly a segmentation in the market that is happening. And I think part of that is these family offices, like, it's a lot of really interesting genesis stories. So, like, there's been no script. And part of it is, it could be multi-generational wealth, and it could also be people who are relatively, you know, it's new wealth, it's founder wealth, or it's like, we go back to SpaceX, a lot of people were printed as multi-millionaires and billionaires as of a few weeks back, right? So I think what is playing out is there are some folks who I think who continue to want to be very hands-on and build out technology and build out a real staff and kind of run it like they are a professional money management firm in a lot of ways, much like an Aquiline. But I think there are a lot of folks who I think you see fatigue and trying to continue to find people that you continue to scale. And I think when that's where you're seeing that other segment of the market saying, okay, like, I wanted to find my family office. This is where we start and stop. And then all of this work to kind of bring together all of these disparate data sources, I'm going to go outsource to someone.
Mm-hmm. How does that look in Europe as compared to the US? Do you have evidence on a differentiation in the European family office market as opposed to the US, where basically the music plays and all this wealth is largely concentrated?
Yeah. Well, I think I'll use an American baseball analogy, but I still think we're relatively early innings in the family office, kind of what it will ultimately be. And I think it is always going to change and adapt and shape shift, right? It's just the nature of markets, and it's the nature of also complex wealth management. So, and I think in Europe, now we have a much better view here in the US to qualify, but I think what you're seeing kind of in Europe and even in Asia is this. There's no institutionalization. It's people trying to wrap their brains around, okay, how do we manage this wealth? How do we actually start taking in technology and some marriage of technology and services to be able to bring some real kind of, you know, industrial grade vigor to how they manage money? But I think it's much earlier days. But I'll qualify it by also saying, I still think the US has a lot of room to evolve. And I, part of it goes back to what I said before. I think the complexity factor will become increasingly more acute.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned private investments and private markets. And obviously, recently, we've seen a lot of turmoil in private markets, at least with private credit funds, BDCs. Does that influence how family offices view this market, or do they take sort of a longer term view throughout that?
Yeah, I think the opacity that exists in more illiquid investments and private markets, I think you're going to see this continued push for people to see more transparency. And even where you're seeing from sponsors who are setting up vehicles that have more, you know, you have access to liquidity more quickly, right? So it's not the, I'm going to commit to your, well, 5-year investment period, 5 years of going out and doing realization and portfolio realization. That, I think, will continue to become harder and harder to sell. I think, you know, you see it even in the, because there's so many assets being held of different types and shapes and a lot of them not having real liquidity, there are a lot of tools that are being built in the space around cash management, or you can call it enhanced treasury management, where people want to get a better understanding of, okay, I'm going into a new year in 2026, show me with some precision what my cash needs are going to be, because I have a set of these, we've had clients who have hundreds of vintages of private equity and venture capital callable assets who have want a better and better view on what their cash needs are going to be. And there are ways that you can model that, right? Now, it's not by any means full 100% we can tell you, because we don't know what the private equity firm is going to do from investing. But there's also, we have all that information in our system. So we know where you are in the investment period, where you are from a committed capital perspective against what you've actually written or committed. I mean, I've sent in. And I think that gives people more comfort around understanding that they're not going to caught, you know, in a liquidity crisis, right? Because it very much could happen. So I think that's part of, I think you're going to continue to see across the people who are providing, you mentioned private credit. I think what you're going to see is a need for people to want to see more transparency.
Mm-hmm. And you said that the opacity and that will become harder to sell, but how powerful are family offices sort of in these credit negotiations as compared to other investors in the market or the other side of the market?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, because I think obviously it's going to depend on size, right? But there's such an appeal for folks to be going through a process of diligence with a family office relative to if you're going through a endowment or you're going, you know, into someone who has a lot more professional rigor around what diligence process looks like and things like that. So I think they carry, and again, going back to this idea that this wealth continues to grow and aggregate, I think just size begets size, right? And I think they'll gain more and more leverage, because there's a real appeal for folks who are trying to go raise money. And especially in an environment like this, you know, well, if I get 3 family office clients writing like decent sized checks, I already have my anchor tenants, and I'm not dealing with necessarily large endowments that have a much different process.
Right. A big topic in financial markets overall is what the Federal Reserve is gonna do under new leadership, and particularly in this inflationary market environment. A lot of folks expect financing costs to increase further in the market. So how will that inform investment behavior of family offices around the assets that we've already mentioned, or more generally, and how will that affect their operational needs?
Yeah. Well, the cost of lending goes up, which feels inevitable in the States, right? You already touched upon it. That, you know, the leveraged buyout market becomes less and less attractive, right? And but again, no one has that kind of, these cycles are much longer, right? And so what it means for new vintages and for people to go out and raise money, I think that's where you're going to see consumption habit change and the ability to be able to have more access to your capital more frequently. I think that's going to be an important piece of this. And I think the sponsors, the sponsors that continue to thrive are the ones who are going to adapt, right? So I think that'll be a net effect. I also think you'll see this, you know, it depends on how sophisticated they are as doing, you know, kind of think about what asset allocation looks like, right? So, I mean, you can use traditional asset allocation models in public markets and, you know, this percentage for equities, this percentage for fixed income, this much for cash. But now, this has changed because you have such a good big chunk of it in alternative investments. Or even you go further where you go and we see family offices who set up, you know, SPVs where they have an asset or a set of assets and then they act like the asset manager, right? Mm-hmm. That's a service that we provide at Archway, is we can literally provide them full ability to act like a general partner. You know, we're going to get you statements out if it's a callable structure, you know, do all the things you have to manage around capital calls, distributions, and make sure that you're doing that all in a compliant way. So I think it'll be interesting to see over the next, let's say, 3 years, right? Or even now with the new Fed chairman, right? Like, I don't think everyone expected, okay, well, now we're going to see continued kind of, you know, reduction in rates. They stood put and the markets weren't happy about it, right? And I don't see how he goes down the path of cutting. And I think by doing that, it'll make people more and more, like, you'll see more people that can go rotate in risk-free at 5% again, right? Mm-hmm. So again, I think that the family offices will get continually better control over their data, which will give them an ability to be able to invest in a more proactive or informed way, right? Like, that's part of it. It's what we talk about at Archway. It's, you know, we're a general ledger system, right? So we have all of the transactions have to come in. You have two-sided, you know, ledger here. We do your balance sheet. We're doing your income statement. So we're that golden source of truth. Now, that's off of that. You can make decisions as to, okay, well, what's the performance by manager or more asset type? And think about how you do both risk decomposition and thinking about look through, especially when you're holding things like ETFs or funds where it's, you know, they have a large number of holdings, because that gives you the ability to get very precise and prescriptive with where you're comfortable with managing risk and how you do it. But you have to harness the data first.
Mm-hmm. You work with some of the largest family offices in the United States. Are these large clients the ones who are looking to act more like asset managers? Or is that broadly a trend in the space?
I think it's certainly size biased, right? I think you're definitely, because it becomes a complexity thing, right? Like, if you're managing, there's nothing trivial about managing $500 million of wealth, right? But if you're doing it and you have a set number of banking relationships and a set number of entities, and I'm not talking in the hundreds or even in the 50 plus range, there are things you can do to keep relatively tight and, I won't say simple, but it's a contained environment. When you start going into wealth like that, and also depends on how the wealth was generated. Some of that wealth has been generated out of asset managers, right? Out of hedge funds, out of traditional investment advisory firms, things like that, where they already have that internal ability to be thinking like portfolio managers. And so they take that discipline and they apply it to their family office. But I do think there's a clear size bias. But that's the thing, you know, I talk about this a lot. You know, what you're seeing is there's been a lot of how pieces have been built for family office services has been very kind of a lot of point systems, right? Systems that if they talk to each other, the interfaces are not well developed. Sometimes they're just unidirectional, which to me doesn't, you know, my old world in the trading business, you couldn't go off and send an order out to an exchange and not process the acknowledgement back and then obviously process the reports back. So to me, I think you'll see this continued evolution where you have an ecosystem where the systems that you need to perform all the things we've talked about and broader estate planning, tax preparation, right? And then all of these, even like there's OCIOs now that are springing up, right? BlackRock's of the world are taking their expertise and saying, we can act as your outsourced CIO. You don't need to go hire that. And now you benefit from this industrialized complex that has a whole suite of trading strategies and has all the track record that it has. So I think that what you'll continue to see is going down market just from an asset perspective under management, although I think complexity is a big factor that feeds that as well, I think you'll start seeing people want to consume more of that. But I think they're going to want to consume it from providers, not go, let's go develop that in-house.
Mm-hmm. It's a cost factor in the end as well.
It's a cost factor. And there's also I guess I would say there's a scarcity problem, right? How many people are really good at managing complex wealth and doing it in a relatively proactive way? You could argue, obviously, AI will be a big piece of that and be able to kind of get, you know, agentic AI will have the ability to do some of that. But I think, and how much you have to pay the people that are really good at it, you go down the asset under management scale, like people are going to go spend that money. So that's where I think that the OCIOs, the outsource CFOs, you know, the accounting firms and thinking about how they're trying to provide services, I think they're all thinking about being service providers and where they can go to in front of a family office says, you know, don't go build that out. Or we understand you have frustration points as you're scaling and the problems are becoming more complicated or more broad to solve. Come talk to us. And we've got this machine, like, so we can handle all the things you do. And you're paying us like, you know, in some fractional way.
Mm-hmm. We've seen some turmoil in the accounting space in the United States, a lot of criticism of accounting firms. The reporting environment for public companies is changing under this administration. On the other side, on the family office side, do you think that the accounting and reporting environment for them is becoming somewhat more complex?
Yes. I think the complexity comes again from the underlying holdings, right? And I think we have a regulatory backdrop in this country now that I kind of alluded to it, right? It's changed. And I think that there's been scrutiny attached, but I also think there's I just think it's a moving target. And I think people are trying to be mindful of, especially when the asset concentration gets so large and when they're meaningful LPs at various firms, I think that they're just being held to a standard that of reporting. Now, this isn't, the SEC isn't overseeing this, right? You don't have that like I had in my old world, but I think that it is the establishment and evolution of better practice, forget best practice, I think will continue to evolve, which means that the onus or the overhead of having to manage this and be compliant, I think will become more and more, you know, I don't think that would be punitive per se, but it's just going to be a heavier lift.
Mm-hmm. What about the tax preparation side? You mentioned that is also a major factor that family offices are looking to outsource.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think that, you know, the tax side of it is, you know, it's a byproduct of when you're managing these multi-entity structures. And then when you look at kind of ownership and ownership all looks different based on, you know, what family members are involved in each entity and you nest entities. This gets complicated quickly, right? Like, so that's where the strength, you know, going back to Archway, its genesis was a general ledger system. And what it's really good at is doing partnership accounting. These are big partnership structures or many partnership structures stuck within one large holding co. And so that for traditional accounting systems, it becomes they're good at running operating companies, not when you start thinking about all this embedding of asset holdings. And so now what you have to do is get very granular with like proper tax lot accounting and understand how you do that attribution or even when you get distributions, how you do that, right? And how, so like these get, like the data has to get really a precise, very granular so that you can feed it into the tax prep folks who can make sure that they are being, you know, this is an evolving need. I think if you go talk to the folks who are partners at big accounting firms, I think I would expect it's a conversation they're having internally a lot around, okay, how do we evolve our accounting practice to be able to capture a bigger part of that? Because it's also a big wallet, right? It translates then into, like, what are the big banks doing, all the big wealth managers? And they're very keen to want own a real part of that ultra high net worth wallet. They know that they're not going to ever own all of it, maybe in some rare occasions, but I would think that just by fiduciary responsibility, you'll have diversification. You're going to try to stay away from concentration risk. But all of the folks, these big banks who run large wealth management businesses, they spend a lot of time thinking about family offices, you know, and this concept of mind share, which is, okay, I'm not going to have all the assets, but I want to be able to, when they're thinking about the various providers, they think about ABC Bank because we're not just giving them a whole suite of investment options. We're also giving them like lifestyle management. Like we can give you things like we'll deal with your accounts payable side. We'll deal with your bill pay side. Like that stuff, like there's a lot of moving parts. And I think that's what people are looking for is to, because the more manual these processes are, just by definition, they're more error prone, right? That's just the nature of manual tasks. And so I think this continued automation and integration of systems, processes, and taking processes and starting to automate them and through partially through AI, right? I think that's going to be the trend that will continue to evolve.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, AI, how do you think this technological trend that's still so much in its ascent will shape the market also with regards to the security concerns that family offices may have with regards to the application of this technology?
Yeah, I mean, I think that to address your last point, right, if they think about security of it, like I think back to how people wrap their brains around putting data in a public cloud, right? Because when they started talking about the hyperscalers and people putting up all this data up into some nebulous space, then a lot of people were just like, that's anathema. Like, I don't see us doing that. Now that, I'm sure there's some people left, but there are not a lot of people who have that thinking anymore. And there's plenty of evidence that you could say your data is a lot safer sitting up in Azure or in AWS than it is in a private data center. So I don't know if it's a perfect analog, but I think it is certainly salient to this conversation, which is, okay, now, because with AI usage, now you, to your point, right? Now you have these large language models and you saw the last version of Claude that came out and people are concerned. They pulled it out of the market. And so there's, I think you said it exactly right. I'm going to go back to the baseball analogy. It's early innings. I think it's like first inning in AI world, maybe even like top of the first. And I think that what is going to continue to evolve is people thinking through practical, thoughtful applications, setting up proper data security measures. There's certainly, and I think that will evolve as well. And I think what, you know, when we think about it internally, we think about AI manifest in kind of three verticals, right? We think about it as it manifests in our products. So our client experience, our user interface, the ability to interact with your data in a much more proactive way through natural language query, right? Be able to say, hey, Archway, tell me where my exposure to SpaceX is. And boom, here you go. I can see it through funds, SPVs that might have been set up. We see it also in our software development process and what that SDLC process will evolve to through things like Claude Code and using GitHub Copilot and whatnot. Because there'll be, like you see, like, I don't think it's FOMO, but I think people are very much, every time you read another report says, well, we just took out 20% of our programmers, or I'm getting, you know, twice as much capacity done now because of our ability to generate code using these models, which, by the way, all very legitimate. I just think, then you get someone who takes that big logical leap to, well, I think I'm going to be able to replace all my programmers within whatever, 12 months. I think that's fallacy. And I think it's losing the journey will be the people who do software engineering and product design are going to become better and better users of this technology and understand that, you know, again, these are based on neural networks, which are non-deterministic. And we live in a world for particularly, like, I can't do that. I have to be 100% right when I give someone any form of financial reporting. So from my perspective, it's we need to retrain the people we have and to adapt to a world that clearly is changing in that software development channel. And then that third being very much, we run not just a software company, we run a services company, right? We do portfolio reconciliation and bill pay for our clients. Well, those processes can become a lot more efficient through using things like agentic AI. So I think all of those, you know, early chapters, but I think that you'll see that continue to become more, you know, just pervasive, more broadly used. But I think there'll be winners who get the understanding that there needs to be, I think, real, I don't know, better practice will evolve.
Well, that makes sense. As a technologist, how worried are you about this rapid development of this technology? I mean, Anthropic, as you mentioned, came out recently and asked for a global stop in development of these models. Now the US government is getting involved with regards to OpenAI, asking them to sort of parse out the release of their new model. So isn't there a larger concern here that we're losing control of the development?
Yeah, well, you know, that stop on Mythos was very much geared towards the fact that they discovered, they released it to, 30-odd companies, large companies. And what they're finding is this has the ability to do things from a analysis of legacy code that has never been seen before. I mean, getting to the kernel level, you're getting into, the machine level. And so, yeah, I think there should be real – I don't think people overreact, right? There's always this – finding equilibrium is hard, right? People go to one side of the spectrum, they come back and overcorrect on the other side, and then to some degree you see some kind of convergence to a mean. And I think that's what you're watching here. Now, that said, we live in a very digitally leveraged society now, right? Which means a lot of our data, this idea that there's, we have overarching amounts of privacy as we carry around. I'm obviously picking up, you can't see, but you can, my phone. You know, there's a lot of data that sits on this thing, right? And I think that I used this term in a meeting before, as we're developing and continuing to build out our data security practices, it's digital hygiene. Like, what do you do for digital hygiene? And not just blindly hope that every time I put a software patch on this or an update on my iOS, it's going to solve all the problems, right? And I think that becomes a part of this. So quantum computing isn't even here yet. And that takes the ability for computers to process information to another quantum, pun intended, I guess. And I think that, for us, I think it's being very mindful of, okay, let's use these models. Let's think about how we can both employ them, how we do proper sandboxing of them, not giving data back to the frontier model builders to say, here, I'll go make your model smarter. It's not my job. You guys go and do it yourselves. Right. So, but I cannot give you a definitive answer because if anyone tried to give you a definitive answer, I would be really concerned. Right. All these challenges, it's like the frontier term is interesting to me because I feel like we are on a new digital frontier. And I'm going to be really interested to see who will be the ones who can navigate this. But I think it's going to take a lot of learned people who use these models in ways that they harness the ability to process. There was a stat that came out in the fall of last year that, between Anthropic and OpenAI, they've processed every piece of information out on the internet. So it's it, everything that's been out there. So what's next? Well, obviously, we accumulate more information by the day, but I think it's also the derived data off of it. Like when you go off and you go to Claude, and I make jokes, but it's my new French-American best friend, and I'm always very nice to Claude because I am a little fearful that it might get angry with me. And I don't know what that exactly means, but mostly joking aside, it's really interesting how I think people are going to be really good at using this technology who are thoughtful, who are inquisitive, who aren't looking for someone to solve their problem, but looking for someone to kind of jumpstart and complement their ability. Because we as humans can't gather all this information at that speed, right? Like Claude can literally do that all together in a very, very quick amount of time. And next thing you know, it's like, well, wait a second. You got some of this right, but then you also had, about hallucinations that happened in this. Because if you press it for an absolute answer it can't get to, like a human being stuck in a corner, it's going to give you an answer, an approximate answer. And then you're going to say, okay, now I'm going to go have to ask the next question. I'm going to click triangulate towards a solution. And I think that's going to be, it's just one example, but I think at a broad philosophical way, I think that's how these models are going to be really powerful to folks.
Mm-hmm. In the family office space, is there a distribution along the lines of which family offices are open to working with new technology, to working with AI, and the ones that are not? Is there an old money versus new money contrast here?
What's happened in the family office space, there's been a lot of these community groups that got stood up. Forge is I don't know if they're the largest, but they have to be one of the largest. Fidelity started it. And I think at the time I met with the people back in the summer of last year, they had 2,200 odd family members, I mean family offices, which is amazing, right? And I think they put these meetings, both virtual and physical, together because I think a lot of the practitioners in the family office days, because there isn't all this standardization. It's not like I'm going to open a family office and someone's going to be like, well, here's Family Office for Dummies, open up the book and you can start doing it. It just doesn't exist. And I think so what happens is these folks, the controllers, the CFOs, the accountants, they all want to get together and talk and like talk about, okay, where are you? How did you get there? And then what's your experience been with dealing with other vendors and things like that? Because I think it gives them, like, we run conferences. So again, I've been at this for almost a year. Last fall, we ran two what we call immersion-like conferences, one here in New York and one in Dallas. And we were talking to, as we're kind of cutting our teeth and understanding where the value is derived, the prevailing theme was, I love getting together with people who I don't see because they're come different parts of the country, right? Because we sit, like, I thought did a very nice job. We put together presentations, here's our product roadmap, what else? And they're like, yeah, that was all great, but I really just want to talk to my colleagues. So, okay, that's great. At least we're serving a meaningful purpose here. But I do think it's because it is such a, there's so much opacity in the space. And so I think that you'll see is, people are kind of wrestling with, okay, every day I'm assaulted with information around AI. Okay, well, I'm going to have bosses who at some point, we all have bosses, we have to figure out ways to make them happy or at least have them not yell at us daily. And the way you do that is try to get informed and say, well, actually, yeah, I talked to family office that looks kind of like us and here's what their experience has been. Like, I don't think anyone wants to be the lone wolf in making these decisions either.
A lot of investors struggle with exactly what you mentioned, like keeping up with all this rapid technological development, while at the same time, we live in a world of increased geopolitical risks. The news cycle is so harsh. So how does that affect this sort of duality of problems or this multitude of problems? How does that affect the way that family offices need and want to make decisions? Do they have to act quicker now?
Well, I think getting more agility will serve them well. Like you said it before about, you know, how much does the onset and continued prevalence of AI, does it keep me up at night as someone who runs a SaaS software provider? And it doesn't, I'm not trivializing it at all because I think it's such a critical part of what we're doing. But I also think that we've built trust over 20 plus years of operation, right? And we have wealth that and wealth owners who want as much discretion applied to the management of their wealth as possible. So yes, people can stand up and they can vibe code and they can develop things that used to take months into days or maybe even less, right? But that doesn't mean you've industrialized it. It doesn't mean that you've burned in user experience and you certainly haven't engendered any trust. Haven't. Right? Like if I had that kind of wealth and someone came to me and said, I have this system and me and my buddy hung out in our garage and we built it over a month, you know, please give us your, you know, $500 million. I'd be like, just get out. Like, that's insane. Right? Like this is people who've been able to accumulate that wealth have real savvy, right? At least varying degrees of it. So I think that lever of that threshold of materiality of being able to protect this data, to be able to maintain discretion, I think is an important part of the world that I live in. But I do think that there'll be this continued desire for the family offices to just be more adaptable, right? Because like, if you've accumulated a lot of data over the last 15, 20 years, and it's been accumulated in old SQL tables and things like that, you know, you're losing the power of new database technology and being able to do things where you can tap into, you know, again, going back to AI, like you want to use NLQ, you have to have your data, you know, in a much cleaner way and a much more accessible way. Like these models are only as good as the data you train them on. And so I think they're going to want that. That will be the consumer ask will be, you tell me I have a lot of data. Clearly, we've accumulated a lot. Let's say I go to a family office, there's 100 entities. You can just think about what that looks like, has 80 family members it's servicing. Each year, that just becomes a bigger and bigger set, a massive set of data. But that data has the only use that data has is how I can access it to do things like compliance and regulatory reporting, all the things, tax, estate planning. But it's also the power of the data is harness it, find insight, right? So let me go evaluate. I've been over tilted in, let's just say simply, public equity markets. But here's how I've been, you know, wrongly allocated or hasn't been relative to the set of benchmarks I'm using. Like all of that, like being able to take that data and get very proactive and being able to analyze and then get, you know, real explanatory value out of it. I think that's what people are going to continue to want to see.
Mm-hmm. So the market is on the move, it's always developing, and this seems to be a particularly exciting phase. Anthony, thank you so much for your insights. Really appreciate that you took your time and that we were able to meet in person here in New York, because you are usually based out in Indianapolis, even though this is your home.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks again for coming on the podcast. Always glad to chat. Let's do this again soon.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me. And it's great to meet in person. And you should come out to Indiana because, you know, we have there's a lot of plains out there. It's really, really lovely out there. So we'd love to have you.
I haven't been. I'm always happy to come.
Yes, we'd love to have you. So great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ja, das war das Interview mit Anthony Abernathy und ja, seinem American View on Private Markets. Was meinst du, Alex? Bist du zufrieden mit deinem Podcast-Debüt?
Ja, ich habe mich auf jeden Fall sehr gefreut, dabei zu sein. Ich denke, Anthony ist ein sehr interessanter Gesprächspartner mit sehr viel Erfahrung. Man hat ja gehört, er kommt auch schnell auf verschiedene andere Themen rund um künstliche Intelligenz und deren Einsatz oder deren Einfluss auf den Markt, was ja aus seiner Karriere als Technologist kommt. Und ja, ich hoffe, unseren Zuhörern hat es auch gefallen und hoffe natürlich, dass wir uns hier demnächst wieder treffen mit weiteren spannenden American Views on Private Markets. Ich habe da schon ein paar ganz coole Gesprächspartner im Auge.
Larry Fink wäre spannend. Ich habe gehört, er hat ein bisschen was zugekauft in dem Bereich für BlackRock.
Ja, der wird mir hier bestimmt demnächst mal über den Weg laufen. Dann werde ich ihn mal kurz verhaften.
Sehr gut, sehr, sehr gut. Nicht weniger erhoffen wir uns von der Rubrik. Danke dir, Alex, dass du jetzt hier im Team bist. Freut mich mega, hat richtig Bock gemacht und ich bin mir sehr sicher, dass da unsere Hörer was mitnehmen konnten. Gebt uns gern Feedback, wenn ihr das gehört habt, entweder mir oder auch dem Alex. Ich denke über LinkedIn und so ist man gut erreichbar. Wir freuen uns über Feedback. Wie findet ihr die Rubrik? Was würdet ihr vielleicht noch ein bisschen anders machen? Was für amerikanische Gäste würdet ihr euch denn mal im Podcast wünschen? Sammeln wir gerne Infos an uns. Und jetzt wünsche ich aber erstmal wie immer ein schönes Wochenende und natürlich immer ein gutes Händchen bei euren Investments. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Ciao, ciao.